At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Here's where we are as October digs in. Yahoo is in the news again. A vocabulary lesson today, fiduciary responsibility. Can you use it in a sentence? Also, the founder of Nasty Gal from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, the fourth day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, in banking of late, it has been John Stumpf of Wells Fargo, the CEO whose seat is the hottest. In tech, Marissa Meyer of Yahoo, the once but no longer dominating internet company, has been having a rough go of it. That go got rougher today thanks to a report from Reuters about what the company is said to have done in response to orders from U.S. intelligence agencies just last year. We got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
Give me the nuts and bolts here of what Reuters says about Yahoo and this whole thing.
Yeah, the report says that Yahoo, in secret, last year, built special software that would search all of its customers' emails, incoming emails, so emails as they were sent, for specific information that law enforcement officials were interested in.
Okay, couple of things to unpack there. Number one, Yahoo built special software to do this. This is a little bit like last year when the FBI asked Apple to build special tools that would let them decrypt that San Bernardino iPhone. This is the same basic deal.
Yeah, it's very similar. And if you remember, Apple staged a highly public battle against that request. Now, some of the specifics are a little bit different. There are some reasons to think that Yahoo, or there are some reasons why you might understand that Yahoo thought that if they fought this order, that they would lose. And those have to do with previous cases involving basically spying on phone calls and the way that phone calls are sent. So what Yahoo has said is, look, we thought we would lose if we fought this order. Apple clearly fought it loudly and publicly, and there was a different outcome, mainly because the FBI went and got the phone hacked in a different way.
Right.
But yes, Yahoo did essentially what Apple refused to do.
Okay, another thing about this. This is in real time with specificity, a certain phrase, chain of characters, what have you, as they were arriving on Yahoo servers.
Yeah, exactly. And that is unusual. And in fact, security officials have said it's one actually who's quoted in the Reuters story said, I have never seen that before, a wiretap in real time on specific words. So it was not just special program. It was probably a pretty hard engineering problem.
Other companies, we imagine, got similar requests. We just don't know what those companies would be. But certainly Microsoft has an email thing. Google has an email thing, right?
So it is very likely that anybody who's providing email got a similar request, and we don't know whether they complied. And unless there are, you know, anonymous sources like came forward in this Reuters report, we are unlikely to know, because a lot of these, there was a New York Times story about this today. A lot of these requests for information from tech companies are being accompanied by gag orders that prevent them from talking about the request. It all happens behind closed doors.
Last thing to the business nuts and bolts of this. Verizon, as we know and have reported, is in the middle of a $5 billion deal to buy Yahoo. One imagines this will not sit well with Verizon. Yeah?
Well, ironically, Verizon was one of the first companies back in 2013 that we found out was wholesale turning over telephone records of U.S. customers.
Oh, yeah.
To the NSA. And AT&T and Sprint and T-Mobile, the telecom providers, have actually given over quite a lot of information to the NSA. So it would be a little hard for them to argue a lot of moral outrage. But combined with the big hack that Yahoo just suffered, and combined with the way that it sounds like Yahoo handled this internally, which was to bypass its security team, it's possible that they might say, look, all right, this brand is in enough trouble that we want out. But they have been remarkably quiet in the last few months.
Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure.
Ought to add Yahoo's response to Reuters about this story, which goes like this, quote, Yahoo is a law-abiding company and complies with the laws of the United States, end of quote. Yahoo shares up just a touch today. Verizon dropped 1.2%. Read that as you will. Us, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All the cool people in international economics are in Washington, D.C. Today, the annual meeting of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, started this morning. All right, maybe not all the cool people, but a whole lot of them. You know what I mean. Of particular note, policy-wise, is that the IMF has scaled back its estimate for American economic growth this year, citing concerns over everything from the U.S. election to Brexit to rising trade protectionism. Marketplace's Adam Ellington has that update.
IMF chief economist Maurice Obstfeld said the global economy is moving sideways, his term, not mine. That continued weak growth among wealthier countries risks offsetting higher growth rates in emerging economies. In short,
growth has been too low for too long, and in many countries, its benefits have reached too few.
The IMF cut its outlook for U.S. growth from 2.2% down to 1.6%. That was based on lower demand for goods and services and weak business investment. One problem is that monetary policies to boost growth appear to be less and less effective. So says University of Chicago economist Randall Krosner.
People have been relying so heavily on central banks to do all the heavy lifting, but they're only one of the players in town.
Krosner says it takes other policies, such as investment in infrastructure, to juice growth. Chris Varveris is the senior managing director of Macroeconomic Advisors. He cued in on the IMF's stance on the threat posed by a global backlash against free trade and open borders.
Protectionism and uncertainty about policies are two factors that we are very concerned about as factors that could hold back both the U.S. and the global economy.
Varveris did say that compared to the rest of the world, the U.S. is in good shape. No bubbles or factors that would pull the economy into a drastically slower growth track. And the IMF seems to agree, so far, increasing its forecast for next year up to 2.2%. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We shall see in the vice presidential debate tonight how long it takes for the old standbys of this campaign to come up. The emails, of course, and since the New York Times story this weekend, Donald Trump's taxes. Mr. Trump talked about that story in a speech he made yesterday in Colorado.
I have brilliantly used those laws. I have often said on the campaign trail that I have a fiduciary responsibility to pay no more tax than is legally required, like anybody else. Or, put another way, to pay as little tax as legally possible.
Fiduciary responsibility is one of those business phrases you hear a lot, but about which there is some confusion. Here with Sabri Benishour and our explainer.
So about Donald Trump's fiduciary duty.
I think that it's a lot of hooey.
Essentially legal nonsense.
An amazingly manipulative, cynical, and false portrayal of the concept of fiduciary duty.
Hillary Sale, professor at Washington University Law School. Robert Jackson, professor at Columbia Law School. Lynn Stout, professor at Cornell Law School. First of all, this is what fiduciary duty actually is. Hillary Sale.
Technically, we define a fiduciary as somebody who is required to act in the best interests of another person.
That is, to put the interests of someone else ahead of your own interests. So your accountant has a fiduciary duty to you. A corporate board has a fiduciary duty to the corporation.
But these are his personal tax returns. He has no fiduciary duty to cut his own taxes.
Now, let's say we weren't talking about his own personal taxes. Let's say we were talking about the taxes of his corporation.
Fiduciary duties do not command managers to minimize their taxes.
Columbia's Robert Jackson there. CEOs can keep taxes down, but they don't have to.
Corporations do things all the time that might produce a higher tax bill or lower corporate profits.
Cornell's Lynn Stout.
Corporations choose to raise their employees' salaries, and they choose to make charitable contributions, and they choose to operate in an environmentally sustainable fashion that is more than the law requires.
And if anything, CEOs and boards are given legal protection to do those things, not legally required to avoid them, as Mr. Trump suggests. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Hurricane Matthew is forcing evacuations of some parts of Florida and the Carolinas, as many as a million people in South Carolina, according to Governor Nikki Haley. The storm made landfall in Haiti today, earlier today, the most recent natural disaster to hit that country. 6 years after a devastating earthquake, there are still lots of repairs needed to Haiti's infrastructure and its economy, as Gigi Duban explains.
Haiti is probably one of the worst places in the world for this kind of a disaster to hit. Erwin Redlener is director of Columbia University's National Center for Disaster Preparedness.
Haiti is probably the most extreme example of national vulnerability to a major disaster of any type.
He says a country with money, like the U.S., could, for example, retrofit buildings to withstand disasters. When the earthquake hit Haiti in 2010, 250,000 houses were destroyed.
There's lots of people still living in temporary shelters.
About 55,000 people are still displaced, according to the Interagency Standing Committee, a group that helps coordinate humanitarian assistance. Redlener says there are lots of questions about how billions of dollars promised to Haiti were used.
Many commitments were not actually fulfilled.
And the dense shacks that have sprouted along the hillsides are vulnerable to rain, says Herman Fritz. He teaches engineering at Georgia Tech.
They're prone to flooding, prone to mudslides, prone to landsliding, and so forth.
Chris Bessie is in Haiti now, working for Catholic Relief Services, though not near the area expected to be hardest hit by the hurricane. Bessie says in addition to infrastructure, political issues have slowed the last recovery.
Which makes it difficult to move forward with these larger efforts.
Elections were supposed to take place next week, but that right now is uncertain. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Another installment today of an every now and then series that we call My Economy. A couple of minutes for people to tell us the stories of their own personal economies. Here you go.
My name's Michelle Lacanina, and I live in Oakland. My economy started rolling downhill shortly after I relocated from Oakland, California, to take a job in Seattle, Washington. We'd left our home, a 960-square-foot Craftsman bungalow at the edge of East Oakland, in the hands of our real estate agent, with the naive expectation it would sell in weeks. It was the summer of 2007. The bottom had just dropped out of the housing market, the jobs market, the stock market, and every other market you can think of. All I can remember is being broke all the time. As we closed in our year in Seattle, we had to make a tough choice. Either foreclose on the house and stay in Seattle, or move back. I owed about $360,000. I was not just underwater, I was somewhere below Earth's crust. With the tenacity of a pit bull, I refused to give in to the housing market crash. I freelanced for 2.5 years at 4 different companies, and I moved straight back into my old house. I made the ludicrous decision to go to grad school. Things started clicking. When I look back, my only disappointment is how long it took to recover from those calamitous years. I see people who are much younger than I am with fancier job titles and homes in better neighborhoods. It's difficult to not be distracted by the perceived success of others. I work diligently to count my own blessings. Just having a job, a car, and a place to live in the Bay Area is somewhat of an achievement.
Michelle LaCanina, she works in e-commerce. We would love for you to take a second and send us the story of your economy. There is a place you can do it at marketplace.org. Coming up.
I want to write a business book that's a gateway drug to the business book section for girls like me who may not know that they want to be in business.
A girl boss. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 85 points today, about 0.4%, 18,168. The NASDAQ down 11 points, 0.2%, 5289. The S&P 500 down 10 points, 0.5%, 2150. Google launched a line of smartphones and a speaker system and some other hardware today. Google parent Alphabet rang up 0.3%. Samsung scaled up 1%. Deutsche Bank marked up 1.5% today after taking a breather yesterday because German markets were closed for a national holiday. Germany's biggest bank is under some scrutiny, as we have been talking about. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.68%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Congress passed a bill this summer. President Obama signed it into law that within the next couple of years is going to require food companies to note on product labels whether the contents contain genetically modified ingredients. There is some hope in the non-GMO food world that greater awareness of the issue is going to boost their business. Ditching biotech crops in favor of conventional ones, though, is not as simple as it sounds. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
In the late 90s, many farmers went all in on genetically modified crops, and Jack Bruns, a farmer in North Dakota, was one of them. But then, about 10 years ago, he decided to grow some non-GMO soybeans. His motivation?
To make more money.
Non-GMO soybeans have boosted his profits anywhere from 5 to 15%, but they're a lot trickier to manage. Controlling weeds is more challenging, and Bruns has to handle the non-GMO beans more gingerly during harvest, storage, and transport. The company he supplies to markets them as food grade.
Their buyers want whole beans, not beans with cracks in them.
That wouldn't matter with GMO beans that are destined for animal feed or soybean oil. Another issue, Bruns has to be super vigilant about keeping GMOs at a safe distance. He still grows some biotech corn and soybeans, so they are around on his farm.
Had the best day ever spring we did.
We head to his barn, and Brun shows me an air compressor and hose. He uses them to blast any biotech corn kernels or soybeans out of the nooks and crannies of his equipment. Other people in the supply chain might not be so careful. Bruns once bought seeds that had been cleaned at a commercial facility, and they got contaminated by GMO beans, the kind used with the herbicide Roundup.
You know what a soybean looks like, a little round baby. And then they go on the floor, go here and there, and they just go everywhere. And I would say it's impossible to get every Roundup bean in a commercial facility out.
If beans test positive for GMOs, the buyer might reject the load.
We've never had a GMO come through this facility.
Jennifer Tesh is in charge of marketing at a company Jack Bruns supplies. It's called Healthy Food Ingredients. The firm specializes in organic and non-GMO products, including soybeans, quinoa, blue corn. All the care that Jack Bruns takes to preserve the integrity of his non-GMO beans will be put to the test at Healthy Foods facility in Moorhead, Minnesota. Workers will grind the beans down, mix them with water, and then dip little test strips into the solution.
This kind of looks like a pregnancy test.
They're checking for any genetically modified material. If the beans pass muster, they'll eventually get packaged up and labeled with a code that indicates the exact farmer and lot they came from.
We have a customer that makes soy milk out of our soybeans overseas. They use that same grower code on their finished retail bottle to tell the story to their customers in that market. We know who this farmer is. We know where your food came from.
Just to be clear, this couldn't be more different from the trajectory of genetically modified soybeans, or really agricultural commodities in general. Their origins kind of just get lost in the shuffle as they move through the supply chain. I asked Tesh whether this system with non-GMOs is really practical.
It makes me wonder how much of the food industry can go in this direction. Like, is it really scalable?
No, I think if we were going to say, is this possible for 100% of the food market segment to go to this? Probably not. Is it scalable to continue to grow where these multinationals can start utilizing more non-GMO ingredients if they prefer? Yes, it's possible.
She says with commodities prices down, farmers are interested in the premium they can get with the non-GMOs. And that alone is the allure for farmer Jack Bruns. Do you have any problem eating foods with GMOs in them?
No.
He says non-GMO soybeans are, after all, a niche market, but it's one he's happy to cater to. In Valley City, North Dakota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, we had a woman named Sophia Amoruso on the show. She had just written a book, it's called Girl Boss, about how she had turned the vintage clothing business that she had founded on eBay, it was a company called Nasty Gal, she had turned it into a multi-million dollar retailer. Well, you fast forward to now, basically, and she's not the CEO of Nasty Gal anymore, but she is very much in charge of what's becoming something of a media and fashion empire. That became apparent when we sat down in her office here in L.A. a couple of weeks ago, and I asked her, as I do everybody I talk to identify herself for the recording.
I'm Sophia Amoruso. I'm the founder of Nasty Gal, the author of Girl Boss, the exec. I don't know. I'm doing a lot of stuff.
It's your thing. Well, maybe that's the place to start, right? What is this company? Because you do media stuff, you do fashion stuff, you do retail stuff, you do clothing stuff, you personally do stuff. What do you
I'm
do?
I'm just like a walking, I don't really know. I feel like a multi-hyphenate. I think that's like the word for this generation. I run a fashion company, or I'm the executive chairman of one, but I founded one a decade ago.
Right.
I wrote a New York Times bestselling book, kind of about my life, but mostly about common sense that seemed to resonate with people.
And we've got another one out. It's on the coffee table. Let's give it the plug.
My second book, Nasty Galaxy, comes out October 4th, and they're making a show about my life. Like, what is that?
You're skipping ahead, but let's go there.
Okay.
What is that that they're
what
making a show about?
What is happening in my life? That's the question.
Right? So what happened? Netflix read the book and called you and said, let's talk? Let's take a meeting?
Well, the way the world works is that I met through an attorney, someone at the literary department at WME, which is a talent agency. And then I was introduced to a book agent. And then that is the genesis of Girl Boss. I said, I want to write a business book that's a gateway drug to the business book section for girls like me who may not know that they want to be in business. And then I guess I did. I wound up plugged into many different agents at this agency who I guess now represent me for different things. And they say, strike while the iron's hot. This book's a hit. Who wants to talk to us about it? And so they talked to Charlize Theron about it.
Well, that's not a bad conversation.
And she read it and she liked it. And we had a meeting and she was super cool. And we said, cool. There's this lady named Kay Cannon.
From Pitch Perfect, right?
Who we've
also had on the show. I know.
No.
So when do I get my Netflix show? No, that's a whole different thing.
Exactly.
It's a whole different thing. You said this a minute ago as we were chit-chatting. You don't actually run this company anymore. You're the executive chairman.
Which means like I'm responsible and I call board meetings.
But you don't say day-to-day, do this, do that. How hard was it for you as the founder, as the brand, to say, maybe this isn't my job?
Something that I wanted to happen for a while. It became especially difficult after the book was successful because I was juggling my priorities and, you know, managing, you know, 8 C-level executives about deliverables and building infrastructure and systems and just stuff that is not, I like starting things. I'm creative. I have a voice. This brand is my voice. Girl Boss is my voice. Nasty Galaxy is my voice. I have a podcast now. I'm a host
I know, right? Come on over to the Marketplace.
I'm trying,
Kai. You can be my gig for a while. This company has been around for 10 years, plus or minus.
Almost 10. In November, it's 10.
All right. So this is a tricky question. I'm going to ask it, and you can answer it however you like. It is none of my business how old you are, except to note that you are 10 years older now than you were when you started this company based on younger women's fashion and styles. How do you stay in the mix?
Well, you can wear a denim jumpsuit every day, like I do. That is really how I stay relevant. But I don't know. I mean, I should be going to Coachella. I should be going to like everything that everyone's at just for the sake of research. Do I do that? No. Do I keep an eye on what people are doing? Absolutely. I hire really talented people, some young, some aren't young, who have a great eye, who can be out there in the market. You know, managing taste at scale is wild.
That's a great line. Managing taste
like, how
at
do
scale.
You do
That's
that?
Got to be impossible.
You know, you create tools for people to use that like allow them to look at what a brand is or what the marching orders are. And it allows the brand to become something that's not subjective.
So it's been 2 years plus or minus since we had you on Marketplace.
Yeah.
If we come back in another 2 years, where is this company? What is it?
I would like to have more stores. I mean, we have two in LA now.
Yeah, two retail stores.
Which we didn't. Last time we spoke, you know, Girl Boss has become its own thing and in many ways is a media brand with a television show, with the podcast. We have a Squarespace website, but like that could become a publishing platform. When you have more opportunity than you know what to do with, it can be a good thing or it could be like really distracting.
Sophia, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We talked a whole lot longer than that. Sophia Amoruso and I did. The rest of our conversation is on our Corner Office podcast. She was, by the way, wearing a denim jumpsuit that day. Final note on the way out today, which I will humbly submit as either this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us or more evidence, should you need it, of a tech bubble. 12 South, which is a company that makes Apple and Mac accessories, it's selling a candle that it says smells like a new Mac. It's $24, a mix, the company says, of mint, peach, basil, lavender, mandarin, and sage. I give up. That's it. That's all I got. I mean, do people actually smell their new Macs? That's the thing I don't understand, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow off 85 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 11 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 10 points. That is 0.5%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Madhavan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.